Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, episode 47, for Monday, May 24th, 2010. Colliding with the Collider. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. It's episode 47, Colliding with the Collider. We're going to spend the hour talking with expert Anil Ananthaswamy. He has written and is an editor at New Scientist magazine. He's also the author of The Edge of Physics, and you can find that at edgeofphysics.com. And in his search for the edge of physics, he has traveled to the edges of the Earth to find the largest, most extreme, the most, I guess, the most out of place experiments in the world. Where are they? Why are they there? What are they doing there? And in those travels, he went to the Large Hadron Collider, which, as we know, is located at CERN in Geneva, Switzerland. It's a giant ring under the Earth in which physicists are smashing atoms together. That's right. It's a place for high energy particle physics. And in the tale of CERN and the science and experiments that are going to be happening there and what is already gotten started there, those are also paralleled by a number of rumors and stories and fears about what is going to happen. Is a black hole going to be created that's going to travel through the center of the planet and destroy the Earth? Is it going to blow up the planet? What do scientists know anyway? What right do they have to be playing with such high energies, right? These are questions people have, but unfortunately rumors get their toehold, and the only way that we can fight those rumors is with fact. So today on the show, Anil is going to help us to understand the facts of the Large Hadron Collider and to understand exactly what we are going to be learning over the next years as this giant physics experiment begins. Hi, Anil. Welcome.
Hello, Kiki. Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. Thank you so much for joining me. Where do we want to get started with this? The Large Hadron Collider, it's working, which is good.
Yes, which is wonderful. It's actually working. They're sort of building up the energy levels of the machine slowly. It's not yet running at full capacity, full energy,
right?
But it's getting there. And it's quite amazing how smoothly the startup, the restart of the machine has gone since it began.
Yeah. So can you explain in just, you know, plain English so that anybody can understand what the collider is doing, how it works and what scientists are doing with it?
Okay. So the main purpose of a collider like the Large Hadron Collider is to be able to recreate some of the energies that existed when the universe was really very young. We're talking about a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang. And the idea is that if you create such energies, then maybe you can create certain types of new particles that our theories predict should exist. We haven't seen them. We don't see them in today's universe. But if we recreate those conditions, then maybe we can create those particles and test those theories and verify some of our deepest understandings of how nature works. Now, how do you go about creating such energies? The way to do it is by smashing very, very high energy particles together. So in the case of the Large Hadron Collider, what it's doing is it's circulating two beams of protons. One beam goes clockwise, the other beam goes anti-clockwise. And these protons are accelerated to really high energies. And the way you do it is just by speeding them up. So these protons are beginning to travel almost at the speed of light. Almost, not at the speed of light, but almost. And to give you an idea, the Large Hadron Collider, like you mentioned in the introduction, is built inside a 27-kilometer-long tunnel, about 100 meters or 300 feet underground outside Geneva. And a proton, when it's going around this 27-kilometer-long tunnel, can make about 11,200 trips per second around the tunnel. That's the speed at which it's moving. Now, imagine one beam of these protons going clockwise, one beam going counterclockwise. Then at about, at four points along these this 27-kilometer-long tunnel, these two beams are made to cross. And when they cross, some of the protons just literally smash into each other head-on. And when they smash into each other head-on, they annihilate into pure energy. So for a fraction of a second, you have a very, very tiny region of space, something like 1,000 times smaller than the width of a human hair.
Wow.
In that volume of space, you create pure energy. And that tiny, tiny volume of space is behaving like maybe what the universe was like, you know, in this particular case of the Large Hadron Collider, a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang, that kind of temperature and energy. And the idea is that when you just have pure energy like that, quantum physics tells you that new particles should just pop out. And it depends on the level of the energy. The more the energy, the heavier the particles that will be produced. And these particles then will decay into what we know of as normal particles, like the electrons, muons, photons, quarks, things like that, things that we know of. And we study these final products of the decay. And based on what we see, we can reconstruct what happened when the first particle popped out from this sort of collision of two protons.
Right.
And that's essentially it. I mean, that in it's not really a nutshell.
A good summary all the same. On a humorous front, I mean, my brain immediately goes back to the 80s and the Ghostbusters and the question of crossing the streams. Didn't we learn the lesson not to cross the streams from the Ghostbusters?
I have to plead ignorance here, Kiki. My knowledge of Ghostbusters. All I remember is Bill Murray, was it, walking around with that huge instrument of his, but I don't remember much.
Yeah, but
so you'll have to say what that was.
But that's the important part in this, is that you can have these particles zipping and whizzing around the track, basically, like race cars. You can just let them go. You speed them up, and the giant magnets that are in the collider speed the particles up faster and faster and faster. And you have to cross the streams to make the collisions happen. Otherwise, we won't learn anything, right?
Exactly. So you have, as you said, these giant magnets, supercooled magnets that are creating the magnetic field that's necessary to bend these protons so that they keep going around in circles. And then there are other kinds of magnets and devices that are accelerating the protons as they keep going around and around. And then exactly in four points along the ring, which are diametrically opposed parts of the ring, you cross them, they collide, and there's all this electronics that surrounds this collision point. So the detectors are essentially built around the collision points, and there are four of them called ATLAS, CMS, ALICE, and LHCb. And these detectors are the ones that will actually be studying what's happening when the collisions happen. So when we talk of the Large Hadron Collider, that's actually just the collider. I mean, the accelerator and the collider, the ring.
Right.
And these detectors are monumental pieces of engineering that often go unmentioned.
Yeah, the whole thing. I mean, the experiments where stuff takes place, that is at these detectors. That's where they're actually going to be detecting these little particles, the normal particles and the strange particles and the maybe the Higgs
unknown
boson
stuff.
Particle. Yes.
Maybe the Higgs boson.
Maybe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So these detectors are an integral part of the collider. Why do you think people aren't talking about the detectors as much as the collider itself?
Oh, it's just in the name of the, you know, when we just talk of the Large Hadron Collider, and in popular terms, that means the collider and the detectors. The whole experiment is given one name. So it's not that the detectors don't get mentioned, but we tend often not to mention it in the same breath as the LHC. But the LHC technically just refers to the collider, and the experiments have separate names, and they are beasts in their own right, just as complex as the LHC.
Just as complex and interesting. So what happens in the detectors?
So essentially, when the collision happens, you have this region of high energy density from which, you know, some heavy particles will come into existence, and they will immediately decay. These heavy particles don't last very long. They last for literally a trillionth of a second, and then they will decay. And the end products of the decay are what we can detect, things like electrons and muons and photons, quarks, and things like that. Well, quarks are not really end products, but the lightest end products. And by monitoring the energy and the momentum of all these end products, we can sort of reconstruct what must have happened at the very beginning of that whole process. So when the heavy particles popped out, we can reconstruct what happened. So if you, for instance, you just mentioned the Higgs boson. Now, this is a particle that is supposed to give all other elementary particles their mass. And if that were to be created at the LHC, there are certain theoretically accepted sort of patterns in which it would decay into known particles, like it could decay into four electrons or four muons or things like that. And by watching for these final products, we can figure out what was created. And that's the whole idea at these detectors.
Right.
So you have... Yeah.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, so essentially the detectors, fundamentally what they're doing is they're trying to measure the momentum of the particles, the energy of the particles, and they do this in various ways. And sometimes it's by just depositing the particle in some sort of calorimeter so that they can get the energy of the particle that came out. Some particles just will zip through everything, so the only way to figure out what's happening with them is to bend them in magnetic fields so that you can figure out by the way the particle bends in the magnetic field, you can figure out its momentum and energy and things like that. Oh, yeah. There you go. You got some pictures.
Yeah, so this is an image from the ATLAS experiment. And the ATLAS experiment is one of the detectors in the LHC. And
right.
I think one of the interesting things about this image is you get to see the, the particle traces. And so
right.
You get to see what the data has, what the scientists are able to recreate with the data as to the tracks of the particles
yeah.
as they shoot out of the collision.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And by recreating these tracks, so these tracks are actual tracks that they can measure. They've got all these, you know, zillions of detectors surrounding the collision point, and they're tracking everything that spews out. And by monitoring the tracks, they know the energy momentum of everything that comes out, and they need that information in order to reconstruct what happened. And you can see in this image that, you know, some particles coming out, then it seems to split into two and things like that. And essentially, that's telling you one type of process that might have occurred. And there will be so many millions of different things that are happening. So a lot of times, if you want to discover any particular particle, you have to watch millions of such decay events and, you know, and sort of sift through the debris to find your particle.
Yeah. Do you have any idea, this is facts and figures and numbers, but how many particles collide when they have these beams of protons? How many collisions
take place? So in each direction, counterclockwise or clockwise, you have 2,808 bunches of protons. So each bunch has a certain number of protons. And when these bunches cross, approximately just 20 protons will collide.
Wow.
And the rest will just pass right through each other, which is kind of nice because you don't want to sort of collide everything at once. So in a way, yeah. It works out nicely that the beams are just crossing and not all the protons smash into each other. Just about 20 of them will. But this eventually leads to about 100 billion particles per second.
100 billion particles per second.
Yeah,
and you're rounding
somewhere,
off somewhere, right?
Yeah. So you have 20 of the 200 billion protons that cross will collide. And from that, eventually, you get something like 100 billion particles per second.
Wow. And those numbers, the data that the scientists must be having to deal with that's just astounding.
It's crazy. I mean, you have collisions that are happening at such a fast rate. And then I actually had gone inside the cavern before the experiment was complete. And you can sort of be in the cavern that's just where the computers are. And you're separated from the actual Atlas machine by a few hundred meters. And the computers are literally sort of sifting through the information that's coming through and then telling the detector which collisions to be paying attention to and which to ignore, because the detector cannot keep track of everything. So you have the inner detector, which has detected something. It's sending that information and literally in a pipeline to the computers. The computer is sifting through that information and letting the Atlas detector know, the outer part of it, to say, oh, pay attention to this one, ignore this one, so that it can keep track of the important ones. It's quite an amazing feat of engineering.
Yeah, the computer programming for these detectors, I'm just imagining all the all the people involved and the technology involved, the computer technology, the actual physics that's going on, the engineering technology.
Everything. Yeah. We haven't even mentioned the civil engineering, and people completely forget about just how incredible it was to actually build this machine and the civil engineering effort that was involved. For instance, one of the, the LHC is the world's most powerful collider today. But if history had gone slightly differently, there would have been a much, much more powerful collider functioning in near Dallas,
about
30 miles south of Dallas in a place called Waxahachie. Mm-hmm. And that collider would have been about three times more powerful than the LHC.
Yeah,
and
it was going to be the superconducting super collider.
Yeah, superconducting super collider. Yeah. And there were some things that went wrong with it. One of the things that happened was that the budget for building it ballooned from about $4 billion to about $12 billion in the course of the few years that they were trying to build it. It was supposed to be an 87-kilometer long tunnel. Well, that's about 60 kilometers more than what the LHC is. Now, when they were trying to build it, one of the reasons why the costs ballooned so much was just the cost of the civil engineering involved with the tunnels. And it was such a big tunnel and such a wide tunnel that the LHC decided that they were going to reuse an existing tunnel. So the LHC, before the LHC was there, the same tunnel housed the older collider, which was called the Large Electron-Positron Collider, or LEP. And when CERN saw what happened with the SSC, a lot of the cost was civil engineering costs. They figured that the one way to succeed was to actually reuse their existing civil engineering infrastructure. So they designed the LHC to fit into the existing tunnel. Now, that's actually quite, people don't quite appreciate just how difficult that is. The more the energy of the collider, the faster the protons or the particles are moving. And in order to bend the protons in a given tunnel, you need magnets. Now, the faster it's moving, the more powerful the magnets need to be. It's something like if you think of how Formula One drivers are going around a racetrack. If they're moving slowly, it's not very hard to turn their car around tight bends. Right. But if the car is moving at 200 miles an hour, then you need to be really strong in order to sort of turn your car, steer your car. And that's why Formula One drivers are extremely strong in their upper body. I mean, they especially train to make sure that their shoulder muscles, their neck muscles are, really, really good. And they're extremely fit people. And that's exactly what's happening inside. Well, not exactly, but it's analogous to what's happening inside a collider. These magnets that had to be designed for the LHC had to be so much more powerful than what had been designed for the LEP, because now these magnets had to steer protons that were 70 times more energetic than what had been used earlier. And there you go. That's the collider at Fermilab, the Tevatron at near Chicago.
And that Fermilab, that was the last largest collider.
Yes, that was the, I think that's, yeah, that was a Tevatron, and that is the Tevatron. In fact, it's still running. It was the previous record holder before the LHC started up.
Equally large magnets, I'm sure.
Yeah, gigantic things, yeah.
Yeah, so the LHC, the LHC, we all heard the news last year that as the result of the strength of the magnets that it actually broke.
It was actually not so much the strength of the magnets. What happened was there was an electrical fault and a spark, some electrical fault that happened that actually created a fault in the... It vaporized some of the liquid helium that's used to cool these magnets, blew a hole in the plumbing, and that hole essentially destroyed the magnets around. And some of these big magnets that we're talking about got destroyed because of that rupture in the plumbing. And actually, the liquid helium itself is quite an interesting story, because we just talked about how they had to build really powerful magnets in order to make the LHC work inside the old tunnel.
Right.
And the way you do it is you essentially need extremely powerful magnets that are small. And the only way they could figure out how to do it was by using very, very special superconducting wires that are used in these magnets. But these superconducting wires had to be cooled down to 1.9 Kelvin. That's almost just a couple of degrees above absolute zero. And liquid helium at that temperature is a superfluid. It has this weird quantum property where it can actually slip through cracks. So the welding that you have in the entire system to contain the about 90 tons of liquid helium or superfluid helium, the quality of these welds that you need to do in the plumbing is the kind of welding that you would need in a nuclear power plant. It's extraordinary. And it's one of those pieces of plumbing that got damaged because of the electrical spark and the and the liquid helium vaporized.
Yeah. So they've been able to repair the electrical system, repair the welding cracks, replace the helium, and get it all working again. I love how complicated this machine is.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
So, all the pieces have to work exactly right.
Which is what I think it's hard to appreciate sometimes. Just like take the act of repairing the LHC. You have a machine that is at 1.9 Kelvin. If something goes wrong, you can't just go in there and touch it, because you just can't do that. You have to warm it up to room temperature or tunnel temperature, whatever that is. But basically, you have to bring it up to normal working temperature. And that takes 5 weeks. You can't, it's like having a machine in outer space. You just can't go in there and repair it. And once it's warmed up, then you do your repairs. And then it has to be cooled down again. And cooling down takes another 5 weeks. You need about 10,000 tons of liquid nitrogen and then another, 130 tons of superfluid helium.
Right.
And this whole, just the warming up and cooling down takes 10 weeks. And then whatever time it takes for the repairs. It's crazy.
Yeah, and so... that really gets to a point of how, how long term the planning and the thoughts behind doing this science has to be. This is not a just do the experiment and get it done kind of thing. It's not a quick and dirty experiment. This is something, and I think a lot of people really want to get results now. We've spent, 9 billion? More than that now?
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, on this machine, and then it broke. And okay, is it going to work again? Is it going to break again? What are the things? And people just want it to work and want it to happen. It's kind of, like the NASA and space and the space shuttle and space flight here in the United States. It's
It's exactly like any other complex machinery. The idea that you can build a plane and have it fly the very first time without any problem is, no one would expect that. And whereas we seem to expect that of machines like the LHC, and that's actually unfortunate. I think we have to appreciate that we are dealing with these are probably some of the most complex machines ever made. At any given time, when you have a collider and the detectors, for their time, they will be among the most complex machines ever built, because they're always at the cutting edge of technology. A lot of the technologies that have been designed for the LHC and its detectors didn't exist before the LHC came along. So they have been designed mm-hmm. specifically for this machine. And so almost everything out there is new. And it takes a lot of effort of, you know, to make sure that it's where I'm actually constantly amazed that it works as well as it does, that it hasn't broken down even more.
Even more, yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder how they're going to be updating it as they go forward, you know, if there it advances in superconducting technology. So these superconducting wires that have to be cooled to, you know, less than 2 Kelvin, is that, you know, is it a possibility that someday they might be able to actually have superconducting wires that work at room temperature? And would that make a difference?
Probably, but not at the, I mean, that's a long way off. I think the superconducting technology at this point, all, you know, the kind of things that you need to use for machines like the LHC have actually got to be cooled down. High temperature superconductivity, even that is not really room temperature. They refer to it as high temperature superconductivity, but that's just relative to how low the temperatures are today.
It actually is. So the LHC, these unknown particles, these things, what are we searching for? Because we already know about a lot of the normal particles, what makes up the larger particles that make up normal matter. What are the other things that are being searched for that they're hoping to find?
So when we talk of normal particles, we're talking of all the elementary particles that we know and all the forces that act upon these elementary particles. They're all described by a theory called the Standard Model of Particle Physics. So everything except gravity is described by the Standard Model of Particle Physics. Now, we have discovered all the particles that exist in that model except for one, which is the Higgs boson. And just to explain what the Higgs boson is, when you have the Standard Model of Particle Physics, which has, you know, all the elementary particles like electrons and photons and quarks and gluons, all of the rest, if without the Higgs boson, if you try to calculate the mass of something like the electron or a quark, it turns out that the Standard Model actually prohibits these elementary particles from having any mass. It doesn't allow these particles to have any mass. That is in the absence of Higgs boson. Now, but we know electrons have mass. We know quarks have mass. We measured them in our experiment. So we know that, you know, they're all particles with a certain mass. How do they get their mass? The only way you can, in theory, give them mass is by introducing a field, just like a field like an electromagnetic field that we're all familiar with. They introduce something called a Higgs field. The only difference is an electromagnetic field is a vector field, so that the direction matters, whereas a Higgs field is like the temperature in a room. It just has a value at any given point. It doesn't have a direction. So you imagine that this Higgs field permeates everything. It's all around us. And then when an electron interacts with this Higgs field, that interaction gives the electron a mass. Or when a quark interacts with this field, the quark gets some mass because of its interaction. So it's the nature of the interaction of any given particle, like an electron or a quark, with this Higgs field is what gives an electron its mass, a quark its mass, and they have different masses because they interact differently. Now, So when we talk of Higgs field, every field has a quantum of energy, a unit of energy. So just like the electromagnetic field has a quantum, which is the photon, a Higgs field has a quantum, which we call the Higgs boson. And it's this Higgs boson that we haven't yet found. If our theory is right, we should have found it by now in the Tevatron at the Fermi lab, or even at the LEP, which came very, very close to finding the Higgs, or it seemed like it came very, very close to finding the Higgs, because you know, when they were analyzing all the collisions from the predecessor of the LHC, they saw some weird things in their data that suggested that they might have seen the Higgs, but they didn't have enough collisions or enough energy to be sure. And in a way, there's a nice story linked to the transition from the LEP to the LHC. Yeah. You know, in 1999, the LHC was all, you know, they were getting ready to build the LHC. in the same tunnel, and then the LEP came very, very close to finding the Higgs, or that's what they thought.
And so then they say, why do we need to build the LHC if we're so close to finding it, maybe?
actually, they did a slightly different thing. They decided to upgrade the LEP to just double its energy so that it had more potential for discovering it. But it also meant that they had to run it for longer than its scheduled time. It was supposed to end sometime in 1999 or around that time, but they doubled its energy from 91 giga electron volts to about 200 giga electron volts. So doubling its energy made it a more powerful machine, and then let it run for a little bit longer. And of course, the LEP never found anything, did not find the Higgs. I mean, it found a lot of other things, but not the Higgs. But what ensued at that point was actually very interesting, because some of the things that had to be built for the LHC couldn't wait until the LEP had finished its run. So with the Atlas, you know, you showed the picture of the Atlas detector. Now, that is a massive, massive detector. If you go down into the cavern is about 35 meters or 100 feet plus high. And that cavern, of course, is bang in the middle of where the LHC's tunnel is, right? It's actually the LHC, the machine runs through that cavern. But before they could build the Atlas cavern, the LEP was still running. And they were trying to dig from the top in order to go and construct the cavern. But they couldn't use normal techniques like explosives and other sort of easier methods to excavate. Yeah. So they had to use very carefully. They had to sort of dig their tunnel, their shafts. And they dug two giant shafts, which were about 60 meters deep. The LEP was still running underground. And they dig these two shafts, and then they have to dig the cavern. But of course, they can't dig the cavern because the LEP is still running. So what do? They actually build the roof first, even before they've dug the cavern. The roof is about 10,000 tons. It's a vaulted ceiling, about 10,000 tons in weight. They construct the roof, and then they hold it up using cables. And then the LEP is finally finished. It doesn't find the Higgs. They dismantle the LEP, and then the people start digging the cavern underneath. And they're digging this giant cavern, which, you know, which requires about 300,000 tons of rock to be taken out. And they're doing all this while the 10,000-ton ceiling is hanging over their heads. And they finish digging out the cavern. They, you know, build the floor. They build the walls. And finally, they take off the cables that are holding the ceiling. And the civil engineering was so precise that the ceiling just moved a few millimeters before it settled on the walls and the cavern was complete.
Wow.
And, you know, this kind of civil engineering was just quite extraordinary.
Yeah, to be able to continue to run the LEP, to be able to do this at the same time, and yeah.
Absolutely. And there's one other neat story about the civil engineering. So when you think of something like the Atlas detector, now that is called an experiment. That's the one that's going to detect, is going to be looking for Higgs boson. But in science, every experiment needs to be confirmed. So if Atlas finds the Higgs, how do you know it has done the right thing? Now, you can't wait another 20 years to build another, you know, collider and experiment in order to confirm what Atlas is finding. So what they do is they build two detectors. And so they've built another one called Compact Muon Solenoid, or CMS, which is situated diametrically opposite Atlas. So Atlas is built near the CERN headquarters, near Geneva. And CMS is actually at the base of something called the Jura Mountains, which date back to the Jurassic era. And that's the only place they could... they had to build it diametrically opposite to Atlas for technical reasons. But that particular piece of land was really, in terms of civil engineering, a very horrible place. Because as they had to build these shafts, the land beneath was just gravelly moraine. And it actually had two aquifers running through. There was two underwater rivers that were running through that piece of land. So when they were digging, the thing would keep caving in.
Oh my goodness.
And they couldn't essentially build their shafts. So what they did was just extraordinary. They drilled these holes, 60-meter deep holes, all around the periphery of the region that they were supposed to make their caverns and shafts. Then they, for about 6 months, they circulated brine at about minus 5 degrees centigrade. And then for a month, they pumped liquid nitrogen into those pipes. And what they did was they froze the water. They created a 3-meter thick wall of ice, a cylinder of ice, around the land that they were supposed to be working in. So they kept the water out. They froze the soil. Wow. for the time that they, and then they did all their civil engineering. This is a technique that miners use routinely in mining when they encounter underwater rivers to do their drilling.
You have to stop the water somehow. So,
yeah, this was incredible.
There was the other story. You said that there's in the tunnel, taking out the tunnel itself. There's actually the tunnel has become an air bubble. Or there's a part of the tunnel, which detector?
It is the ATLAS detector. Okay. So the ATLAS detector is, they had to take out 300,000 tons of rock. And inside they put the detector. The detector weighs about 7,000 tons. So essentially you've got a 300,000 ton piece of rock missing.
Yeah.
And that's like an air bubble inside the rock. But it's so huge. It is so huge that it actually pushes up against the rock above. It's like a bubble of air in water. The same idea that if you have something of low density, surrounded by something of higher density, the lower density bubble is going to move up, and that's exactly what's happening. And the cavern in the early stages of its existence moved up about 0.2 millimeters every year. And the great thing about it, I feel, is that they actually knew this and predicted it, and engineered all their instruments to accommodate this. So, starting with just the floor, that the floor is about 5 meters, about 20 feet thick, layer of steel reinforced concrete, so that even though the cavern moves up, it doesn't warp; it moves up as one. And then all the other instruments have to be monitored to make sure that they know exactly where their detector is, precisely, in order to do their measurements. You know, you're measuring things that are barely the width of a human hair. And you have these tons of equipment, things that are warping because of temperature changes, all the electricity that's being used. There are the ATLAS. Yeah. The ATLAS detector has a 6-megawatt substation underground just to feed the ATLAS detector. Six megawatt.
I've heard rumors of the energy in running the LHC, that if they powered up to 100%, that the amount of power going into it is like the amount of power necessary to power Geneva.
I think so. You're not far off the mark. I think it's something like that. I don't have the numbers exactly in my head, but it's something astounding like that. Yeah.
So not necessarily, a green technology at this point.
No.
No. I need to take a break very quickly for a word from our sponsor. So if you just hold tight, Anil, we'll be back to the conversation with some questions from people in the chat room in just a moment. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Audible.com. Audible.com is the leading provider of audiobooks online. You can get over 75,000 titles. 75,000, that's a lot of titles out there. And among those titles are science books. Science, there are also other ones. They have lots of different kinds. Genres ranging from biographies, fiction, nonfiction, science. I just keep coming back to this, don't I? But anyway, our sponsor, Audible, is giving people who sign up through listeners who listen to the show and who sign up a free audiobook download. And so you can go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki and get a free audiobook download. And if you're interested, I actually had a suggestion for you that, let me see if I can get my link up. I actually had a suggestion for you all that you can download. I think this is a pretty good book. It is a book that I have read myself. And actually, we are speaking with the author right now. Anil Ananthaswamy's book, The Edge of Physics, is available on audible.com. And you can read the story of his visit to the LHC in his book, The Edge of Physics, and a number of other places that he visited as well. And this is it's a great read, and it really takes physics to the edge, to the extreme. And so if you're interested, you can go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki and you can download The Edge of Physics, or you can download any other book for free. as a gift from Audible for signing up. So thank you very much to audible.com. Go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki for your free audiobook download now. So, Anil.
Yes.
Moving forward, one of the main, like, big questions that people ask about big, expensive physics experiments such as the LHC, what good is it? What is it really going to do? I mean, is it just because we can?
Oh, no, no, it's not just because we can. I think we are, when we do experiments like the LHC, we are satisfying, I think, what is a very basic human impulse to understand nature. So, you know, when you think back to the early 20th century, we were doing similar things with quantum mechanics. We were understanding our universe, our material world in a way that must have seemed very strange at that time. People were talking about waves and particles and this and that. And you could have asked the same question at that time saying, are we doing it just because? And it's never just because. And now fast forward 100 years, you and I are talking over Skype and, you know, the internet and things like that. All of that is possible only because we understand physics at the level that we do. All of the quantum mechanics, all of, you know, the wonderful stuff we know about electrons and fields, and that's necessary to make the modern technology happen. It could not have been foreseen 100 years ago, but it happened. And I think, in a sense, you have to look at LHC the same way. It is about satisfying a basic urge that humanity has, which is to understand our place in this universe, our surroundings, nature, all of those things. And what comes out of it is hard to predict. Again, you can go back a little, you don't have to go back all the way to the early 20th century. You just go back a few decades and think of similar colliders that were built. The technology that was used in those colliders is now commonplace in hospitals around the world, all the scanners you know, the kind of things we need to do for cancer therapy, the accelerators that we need to, all of those things came out of particle physics. Again, if you had asked the particle physicists 40 years ago that will your technology be any use for, you know, treating cancer, they would have had no answer. But, and I think you have to take any basic science sort of with that in mind, that it's a long game. It's not something you're doing just because there is an immediate payoff tomorrow.
Yeah, and with the search for the Higgs boson, and basically, if we find it, it confirms the standard model, right?
Right.
But if they don't find it, what is that? Does that necessarily mean that the standard model is not correct? Does it necessarily mean that the theorists need to focus, that the experiments need to start focusing on other models? Where does it go?
Yes, well, maybe we can just mention briefly that even if they find the Higgs, the standard model itself, we have enough clues from other experiments that the standard model is not complete.
Right.
And take the Higgs itself. We talked of how elementary particles like electrons get their mass by interacting with the Higgs.
Yeah.
Now, there's another question in the standard model. How does the Higgs get its mass? We know that the Higgs experimentally must lie between about 100 times the mass of a proton to about 200 times the mass of a proton. We know that. We know that range from the experiments that we have done. But when you try to calculate in the standard model how the Higgs gets its mass, it gets its mass partly by all the interactions it has with other elementary particles. And you add that up, and it turns out to be 17 orders of magnitude greater than what experiments think it should be, tell us it should be. So something is badly wrong with the standard model. And this problem is called...
I love it. Something's really wrong with it.
and the physicists, they know it. They call this problem the hierarchy problem. The fact that the standard model has this discrepancy. If you just use the model as it is, you get an answer for your Higgs mass that is completely out of whack from what experiments tell us it should be. Now, that's telling us that there is some other physics beyond the standard model. And one favorite model that the physicists have is something called supersymmetry.
Right.
And what this is doing, this model is doing, it essentially doubles the number of particles in nature. So every particle that we know of has a partner particle, and it's called a super partner, right? And these super partners would have existed in the very early universe when the universe was hot and dense and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, we don't see them around now. The hope is that if the LHC reaches the energies of the early universe, then maybe some of these particles will be created. But what supersymmetry does to the Higgs mass problem is that these interactions that I was telling you about, where the Higgs has interactions with other particles, by adding this extra doubling the number of elementary particles that we have, these interactions tend to cancel out properly, so that essentially you get, the theory then predicts the kind of Higgs mass that we expect. So what physicists would really like, in fact, for my book, I had been asking a lot of people about this question, and one physicist, Steven Weinberg, the Nobel laureate, he was very emphatic that if the LHC finds only the standard model Higgs and nothing else, he would be very, very disappointed. In fact, he called it is pretty much his nightmare scenario, because
yeah.
What that means is that we've verified the standard model, but we know the standard model is not complete, because at the very least it has this strange problem called the hierarchy problem. It also doesn't explain things like dark matter in the universe.
Right.
And so we know we need hints about what lies beyond. And if the LHC doesn't find anything else, say it doesn't find any clues about supersymmetry, then we will actually be in quite a lot of trouble. So it's almost as bad as not finding the Higgs.
All right. So what are the dangers? Are there any dangers? Safety issues? That's another question that people seem to have.
Yes.
You know, we think every once in a while that, okay, there's been a really good job done by scientists talking to the media to actually discuss some of the questions of the black hole issue, whether or not the Earth's going to be swallowed up by a black hole created by the LHC, or you know, any number of other issues that have been brought up. Scientists
right.
have tried to respond to that, but still, not everyone hears those responses. So, is there anything to worry about?
I think we should
about?
Talk about.
Yeah,
there is nothing to worry about, but we should talk about it in a sensible way, so yeah. that we can allay these fears. And
yeah.
you know, first of all, microscopic black holes, which is what people talk about, these are not the kind of black holes that we see in you know, when we look out into deep space. Those are astronomical black holes, much more massive and, in fact, giant things. We're talking of microscopic black holes. And if you just use the physics that we know today, you know, Einstein general relativity and quantum mechanics and, you know, the known physics, there is no prediction of microscopic black holes being created at the LHC. But there are some theories, some speculative theories, where you can expect microscopic black holes to be created. But these black holes are so small that, and they will decay almost instantly. They will not accrete enough, you know, they will not last long enough to accrete and become big. And, you know, so those concerns are almost, you know, non-existent. But there's also one more important thing to point out, that the kind of energies that is being created at the LHC, or will be created at the LHC when it's running at full power, nature is doing that around us all the time. Cosmic rays from deep space that come and hit the Earth's atmosphere, they are much, much more energetic than the kind of collisions that the LHC is doing. So if indeed high energy collisions create microscopic black holes, well, they should have been, they are probably being created all the time around us in the universe, all over the universe, and also, you know, on Earth. And we know from just the fact that we are here, that nothing has happened. So,
right.
I think
there have been cosmic rays that have come through the Earth, that do go through the Earth all the time. It's not just empty
yeah.
space that these cosmic rays move through. They impact the
yeah,
Earth,
so,
they travel through, nothing has happened.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, scientists calculated that the cosmic ray collisions with the Earth's atmosphere or with the Earth has already conducted a million LHC-like experiments, or a billion, I have the number somewhere here. But it's, you know, those kind of collisions over the Earth's 4 billion year history have already been conducted around us, and we are still here. And in that sense, you know, this is really not a concern. We shouldn't be worried about it.
Good. I don't know if just saying that and putting that out there will you know, allay people's fears and maybe their enjoyment of liking to think that something could destroy the earth.
Well, there are some people, especially here in Europe, who keep pointing out that the black holes that might be created by a cosmic ray colliding with the Earth's atmosphere would be moving too fast. It wouldn't be moving slowly enough to actually accrete matter, become big, mm-hmm. and gobble up Earth. Whereas the black holes, microscopic black holes that might be created, the LHC, would be moving rather slowly, and then that could create problems. And even to that question, the scientists at CERN have pointed out that these kind of collisions must be happening between cosmic rays and neutron stars, which are really, really dense objects, which are remnants of dead stars. Mm-hmm. And so if a microscopic black hole was created in that interaction, it would be slowed down by the neutron star. It would essentially get captured by the neutron star. Mm-hmm. And then the same logic would apply. If you have a sort of slow-moving microscopic black hole, it should somehow gobble up the neutron star. But we monitor neutron stars all the time. These things must be happening there all the time. And they don't go away. They are there. And so, again, even to that sort of concern, I think the CERN scientists have really, they've taken a look at it. It's not that they've ignored these concerns. They have taken a look and they've come up with, you know, the scenarios that they think explains it best.
Yeah, and the other concern, and it's not just with the LHC, but with a number of scientific issues these days, is the question of whether scientists actually know what they're doing enough to be doing these really high energy experiments, or, you know, to be pushing the envelope in the way that they are. The argument is, well, so many times, you know, you see after the fact the result of something. Oh, I didn't expect that to happen.
I mean, do they know exactly what will come out of these collisions? No, there will be unknowns. But again, it's not a dangerous unknown, because these kind of collisions happen around us in nature all the time. In fact, far, far more powerful collisions between particles happen around us in nature all the time. And from all we can tell, there is absolutely no concern. So, but in terms of the actual physics that comes out of, you know, what happens in the collider, do they know every little bit? Definitely not, because that's the whole point of doing this experiment. They are actually expecting to find new things. And in many cases, they don't know exactly what these new things might be. But there's a difference between saying that and saying that there might be a danger. I think those two are separate things.
What do you think is, one of the biggest challenges to the LHC now that it's running?
Oh, they're running at sort of a midpoint of their final energy range, mm-hmm. final energy. So they have to reach, each beam that's circulating has to reach about 7 tera electron volts. That's, and right now I think they're at about 3.5. So ramping up to the high energy means everything else that's surrounding, you know, the magnets, all of those things have to start working to their full capacity. Mm-hmm. And it has never been done. So that's one big challenge. Also, I mentioned earlier that each beam has about 2,800 bunches of protons going round and round like little carriages behind each other. And right now they just have one bunch in the entire 27-kilometer long tunnel that's right. going round and round. So they have to inject 2,800 more bunches and make them all go behind each other properly and collide at the right time. So there are a lot of technical challenges left. And, and that's just making the machine work. There's a whole different bit about how do you analyze the collisions. Mm-hmm. And one very beautiful thing that happens with these colliders is that the past discoveries sort of become the calibration tools of the new machine. So you showed a picture of the Tevatron at Fermilab.
Right.
So the Tevatron had discovered and studied the properties of things like the top quark and the W and Z bosons and all these, you know, fancy particles for their time, but now they're really well-known particles. And mm-hmm. the LHC has to create those particles and the detectors have to detect them. And they sort of use what were new discoveries 10, 15 years ago as their tools for calibration today. And that is the first challenge. They have to essentially verify every little bit of the standard model. And that's essentially, they have to do that to make sure that their machines are working as designed. And then they go forward.
That makes sense. Verify that everything's working and then move forward with the searching and the actual discovery. I believe also with the information in terms of calibration and what they're looking for, labs like the Fermi lab and the Tevatron, they've actually started putting bounds, upper and lower bounds, right, on the size or the mass of the Higgs boson and other particles that they're potentially looking for.
Yeah. So take the Higgs boson. In the standard model, the mass of the Higgs boson is sort of related to the mass of the top quark and the W boson. So it's like a triangle where if you change the mass of any one of the three, the other two will change. So, and they have managed to fix the mass of the top quark and the W boson quite, you know, with high precision. So now they're left with a certain mass range for the Higgs. And they've excluded basically anything below it and anything above it. And they're left with, a certain window. And that window is getting smaller and smaller, which is also a cause for, concern. Why is it at that point? And, by all accounts, it should have been seen by now, by the Tevatron. But it hasn't been, which might mean that the universe may be supersymmetric and we may not get the standard model Higgs. We might get supersymmetric Higgs, which will be a nice complication because it's not just one Higgs. There are five Higgs in some of the supersymmetry models.
And I just have to bring up one of my favorite comics in the entire world, XKCD. XKCD did a Large Hadron Collider comic recently where Large Hadron Collider in CERN, moment of truth, the physicist pulls the lever, click, it gets started. Did you see the Higgs boson? Nope. Huh. Well then, until the theorists get back to us, want to try hitting pigeons with the proton stream?
They're just getting back at the bird that hit them.
Yeah, getting back at the bird, exactly. The bird from the future. The baguette from the scientists in the future that was sent yes. back to stop this from starting. I love all the stories that have come up. Large Hadron Collider, I highly doubt that it's being watched by individuals from the future. But who knows? It could be. It could be. We could find a way to time travel in the future. It's very possible.
Who knows?
You're like, no, it's not.
hard to say. It could be. Time travel might be possible. We just don't know yet.
That's right. Were there any more points that you really wanted to hit on maybe we just haven't covered but that are really important about the LHC? We're coming to the end of the hour here, so I want to make sure that we get, everything out.
So I think one thing that we could possibly mention is this idea that the LHC could actually create dark matter in a laboratory setting. And it's a nice convergence of cosmology and particle physics. We know from astronomical observations that there is a lot of mass out there in the universe that we don't know much about, and we call it dark matter. Now, if supersymmetry is right, then it actually provides you with a candidate particle for dark matter. And if all the theories are right about dark matter being a supersymmetric particle, and if that supersymmetry exists at the kind of energy scales that the LHC is probing, then maybe the LHC could actually create dark matter in the machine, which would be quite amazing, because that would mean two things. A, we understand what dark matter is, and B, that the universe is supersymmetric, so it gives us some kind of clue about what the new physics should be. And that would be probably would be a bigger discovery than the Higgs. Yeah. Everyone, almost all the physicists sort of expect the Higgs. They're not going to be, they just think that the Higgs or something that akin to the Higgs should be found. And they wouldn't be very surprised. But if they find supersymmetry and dark matter particle is created, that would be a mind-bending discovery.
Yeah, it would be a mind-bending discovery that would change a lot of ideas, and it would really move physics forward in a new way. Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the, I think there's another one of the detectors, as I was looking at all the different detectors, one of them is also potentially probing the antimatter issue.
Yeah. In fact, the Fermi lab people just made a big splash a few days ago. So one of the big mysteries in physics is how come we have a universe made of matter? Where did all the antimatter go?
Yeah.
Because at the Big Bang, matter and antimatter should have been created in equal amounts, and they should have met and annihilated each other, and all we should be left with is pure energy. Instead, we find ourselves sitting here talking over the phone. So obviously, we're all, you know, made of matter. The antimatter has gone missing.
Yeah.
And one of the suggestions is that somehow there is a tiny asymmetry between how matter gets created and how antimatter gets created. Maybe a little bit more matter gets created than antimatter. So the Fermilab people, they've been monitoring, they've been creating these particles called B mesons, which then decay. And they've managed to show that the B meson seems to decay a little more into matter particles than it does into antimatter particles. So suggesting that this kind of asymmetry could explain why we are left with a universe made of matter and all the antimatter is gone. The LHC, one of the experiments at the LHC is going to, you know, just up the game when it comes to doing the same experiment. It's going to have much higher energies, much more data to play with, and they might actually answer this question pretty definitively.
Cool. I hope they do answer the question definitively. I'd like an answer. I want to know.
I think the antimatter mystery would be a lovely answer to get. I think that's a big issue that's been confounding people for a long time.
Yeah, for a while. So with all these detectors and all the things they're looking for, they're bound to find something, but we don't know exactly what they're going to find yet. Maybe it will verify supersymmetry. Maybe it will verify the standard model. Maybe it will confuse everyone. Maybe we'll learn
it
about
could.
Yeah. Maybe we'll learn.
For instance, if we don't find the Higgs and we don't find any clues of supersymmetry, that would leave us in a bind. If we just find the Higgs and nothing else, that would also leave us in a bind. The best bet is we find the Higgs and we find some signs of supersymmetry.
And then what? The LHC is but one step in the journey of physics, is it not?
Well,
I mean, there will be ever bigger machines.
Well, yes and no, in the sense that the LHC is what's called a dirty machine. And this is a very specific term where, because you're colliding protons against protons, now protons are composite particles, they're made of quarks and gluons. So when the collision happens, you get a lot of messy debris, and sifting through that is not easy. And so the signatures of the particles that come out take a lot of effort. Now, the experiment that was there in the tunnel before this was the Large Electron Positron Collider. So that was just colliding electrons against positrons, which are both elementary particles. And their collision is very clean. And you get much more precise data from such experiments. So the next step, if the LHC gives us some clues about what the new physics might be, that will give the physicists an incentive to ask for more billions for funding for the next, you know, electron-positron collider, because that will be needed in order to study the properties of these new particles, the new physics, in much more detail. But if they don't find anything, then trying to get funding for the next collider is not going to be easy.
Right, and that's the issue. My fingers are crossed so that politicians and the public will continue to want to fund the big, exciting experiments, so that we learn more.
So Kiki, your fingers and the fingers of about 9,000 physicists around the world are crossed.
Exactly.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I've loved talking about this. The LHC is something that is captured the imaginations of, you know, millions of people around the planet, and it's an amazing feat of engineering, of technology, of science. And thanks for bringing all the information to the show today, Anil.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Kiki. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
You're welcome. And you, if you are interested, dear audience, in learning more about the LHC and learning more about Anil Ananthaswamy, you can find his book, The Edge of Physics, all over the place. It's in bookstores. It's on the web, edgeofphysics.com. He has a blog too, and he writes and talks about interesting high physics and extreme physics experiments that are ongoing. He's also, his writing is around and about, and you can find the interesting things that he has to say all over the place. Anil Ananthaswamy, again, The Edge of Physics, and this has been the Large Hadron Collider, discussing colliding with the collider. I'm Dr. Kiki, and this has been the Science Hour, yet another week, another hour, and your whole world is more interesting, isn't it? You can find me at Dr. Kiki on Twitter. Also, drkiki.tv is my website, and I'm Dr. Kiki on Facebook, and basically, if you Google Dr. Kiki, you should find me at a number of different places. You can find old episodes of The Science Hour at twit.tv/Kiki. And if you need more science, I'm also here Monday nights on the Twit Network, live.twit.tv for This Week in Science, which is really kind of a fun-hearted romp through the science world. It's a little less serious, a little bit more fun, but it's all about science. So you should come join us sometimes, This Week in Science. Tune into The Science Hour next week. I have no idea what we're going to be doing. It'll be something about science, that's for sure. So, I hope you join me then. Thanks so much for watching. Over and out.